from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1982, comic book artist Art Spiegelman won the Pulitzer Prize for Mouse, A Survivor's Tale, the darkly moving story of his parents' experiences during the Holocaust. He's also the artist behind the 1993 Valentine's Day New Yorker cover of a Hasidic Jew passionately kissing an African-American woman. Spiegelman got his early start at the Topps Gum Company, where he drew novelty cards, stickers, and candy packages, including those madcap Garbage Pail Kids. In the 1970s, he began creating edgy cartoons for the New York Times, the Village Voice, and Playboy. He co-founded the politically charged comic magazine Raw in 1980 and published the first of his two mouse books in 1986. Now, Art Spiegelman has just completed a year-long series on New York post-9/11 and is editing a remarkable and challenging new series of children's comic books. Tonight on Point, a cartoon master's view of the world and his provocative comics for kids. Have you seen them? Did you read Mouse? And do we underestimate our children and what they're up for in a comic book? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me now from New York is Art Spiegelman, editor most recently of Little Lit. It was a dark and silly night. Good evening and welcome, Art Spiegelman.
Hi, Tom. Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you, and terrific to have you with us. I read Mouse years ago. It made an enormous impression on me, And I must say, I didn't necessarily come out of it thinking of you as the guy who would put out a series for kids, and yet you've done it. I cracked these open just in the last couple of days, found some stuff that I could recognize immediately for children, and other things that, to my eye, right off the bat, Art Spiegelman, I'm not sure I would have recognized as comics for children. What got you into drawing and editing this new series of volumes for kids?
The Little Lit books? Well, let's see. I mean, first, I did work for kids, actually, even before working for adults, when I worked on the Bubblegum Company for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's just there one dealt direct. The negotiation there was directly with the kid, you know?
The kid
you
gets
got
the gum,
quarter,
opens it, and
the
you're
Bubblegum
there.
Company wants it. Here's a 25-cent transaction, and this is something you want where your parent doesn't have to make the decision. Working on kid books really came for me as a result of having kids. I have a 16-year-old now, girl named Nadja, and a boy who's almost 12 named Dashiell. And I suppose when they were young and I just was giving myself a crash course in children's literature, I got to see what really worked for my kids and what worked for me. And the difference between doing bubblegum cards and doing children's books is one has to entertain both the person on the lap and the person who owns the lap. So right. Otherwise, it's like, I don't know, there's a certain moment where Dash got interested in Thomas the Tank Engine book that he got from somewhere. Yeah. And after four readings, I was willing to toss my kid away, let alone the book. You know?
Please not just, again.
I can't do it anymore. So I thought, you know, certain criteria came into focus. It should be something an adult likes as well as a kid, that kids aren't stupid. It's not a matter of talking loud to them so they'll understand. Mm-hmm. They're actually brighter than we are. They haven't closed down as much. They just don't have as much exterior information. So one doesn't make a lot of references to a world that they can't possibly connect with yet.
But you give them credit for knowing an awful lot at the level of relationships and certainly human interactions. Some of these you've drawn and written yourselves, others you haven't. Can you give us a sense of the sort of stable of illustrators, cartoonists that you've brought in to contribute to these children's books?
Okay, because we wanted to make a book that could be read and reread and reread, since there aren't enough comics for kids, we had to make one that could be read 100 times rather than 100 that could be read once and then disposed of. And so we invited in some of the most accomplished children's book artists to work on comics like Maurice Sendak comes to mind, and Ian Falconer, who did the Olivia the Pig books, and J. Otto Sebald, who did all of the other reindeer, and the guy who did the Where's Waldo books, as well as inviting in writers, some who you wouldn't necessarily connect with kid book writing, but Lemony Snicket, Paul Auster, David Sedaris, all of whom remember clearly what it was to be a kid and what they liked.
So you would team them up with illustrators or cartoonists.
Yes, and then we worked also with some of the, I think, more astounding comics artists that are around now. Patrick McDonald, who does Mutz, did a story in the current mm-hmm. one, and Chris Ware and Dan Close did stories for us, and Jules Pfeiffer. Each book is very, very densely packed. You know, there's enough there where if we just did it as a normal kid book with one picture a page, any one book is so insanely generous that it could have been eight picture books.
I should describe this a little. You're on your third volume now. These are not anything like old-fashioned comic books. They're large format, I don't know, 50, 60 pages with a dozen or more
contributors to each one.
In each one. The first one was focused on folklore and fairy tale funnies, kind of inside-out versions of old stories. The second one...
Well, sometimes just retellings. It depended. You know, like...
Yeah. Give us an example.
I think that we had a comic book story by David McCauley, who did the books The Way Things Work and the Cathedral books.
Sure.
Do you know those things?
Sure, the cross-section of everything on Earth.
Yeah. And he did a very lighthearted but accurate retelling of Jack and the Beanstalk.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of it, he had to learn how comics work. And at the end of it, he said, you know what? Drawing cathedrals is a lot easier.
But then you've got Humpty Dumpty here.
Yeah, that's a retelling by William Joyce, who does Roly Poly Oly and did the Toy Story pictures.
It's terrific.
And stuff like that.
But I guess let me ask you about that. I mean, the old story is, of course, is sort of that I don't know what the lesson is. That some decisions are a one-way street. Humpty Dumpty, you know, fell off the wall. He broke to pieces. He could not be put back together again. This telling turns that around, says no.
Yes, well, let's put them back together again, by gosh. Well, one of the reasons we went to folklore and fairy tales is they were never invented as a children's literature per se, the old folklore stories.
Mm-hmm.
They've come down to us as that. And the reason that they've come down to us is because they're really good stories. They're stories that hit something basic for people. And that lets them survive for hundreds and hundreds of years, far longer than the longest lived Seinfeld episodes, you know, like it just lives. And so one can really wrap one's brain around these stories and work with them. And in some cases, we used rather well-known tales, and in other cases, tales from other cultures that aren't as well-known here, and in some cases, very obscure stories, if that's what caught the imagination of the artist.
You start this particular volume with Prince Rooster. I really like this. It's a Hasidic parable. You say here, could you describe that story for our listeners?
It started because, again, my kids are my editors, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, my editors at HarperCollins aren't my editors. My kids are. And originally, a lot of people in the books were moving toward their own ethnic heritage to look for their fairy tales that they really wanted to work with.
Yeah.
So I figured, okay, maybe one of these stories of the wise men of Helm, which was these nonsense stories that took place in eastern Poland where everybody had a backwards logic. Mm. But Dash took all the backwards logic as totally forwards. It made total sense to him. So I had to look elsewhere. And then I figured, okay, although I'm dealing with folklore and fairy tales, I'm not sure I'm interested in magic. I mm-hmm. looked toward this other tradition, which were the Hasidic wisdom tales.
Mm-hmm.
And in that tale, there's a prince who tells his father he's actually a rooster. The father tries to jolly him out of it, and the kid insists he's a rooster, mm-hmm. Strips off his clothes, goes under the table, clucks, will only eat corn. The king, after failing with all the doctors and wise men of the world, just gets very, very depressed until an old man comes to the door, and the old man says to the king, to the person who answers the door, tell that king that in order to help someone who's stuck in the mud, you sometimes have to get your own feet dirty.
Yeah.
He then he's invited in despite the king's despair. He meets the prince. The old man strips off all his clothes and gets under the table and clucks along with the prince.
So we've got two naked roosters under the royal table.
Two naked roosters under the table. This is very clean.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, they're naked.
Oh yeah. It's right in front of me. The beard is long and white and flowing, and it's all very innocent, but he's getting in the mud with the prince.
Yes.
Who's confused.
The prince is really glad to have a fellow rooster, a friend. After a couple of days, the old man gets up, and the boy is shocked, saying, but wait, what are you standing up for? He says, well, just because we're roosters, we don't have to, like, stay crouched down all the time. And day by day, he gets him to finally put on some clothes and come in to eat in the room. And as a result, the prince is reintegrated into the kingdom's life, and He said, but wait, how can we be sitting here eating and talking like men when we're really roosters? And then the old man, the wise man, says, well, you can walk like a man, talk like a man, and eat like a man, but really be a rooster inside. And as a result, the prince grows up to become a great king eventually, except every once in a while when the moon is full and the sun comes up really early, the prince goes out to the parapet of the castle and says cock-a-doodle-doo at the sun as it comes up.
And crows what he feels inside.
Yeah. So it's a wisdom tale. It has at least three or four morals without feeling medicinal. It feels just like a good comic book story.
Oh, give us the morals for people who haven't read it.
Well, sometimes if you want to help somebody, you got to get your own feet muddy if you want to help them get out of the mud. Mm-hmm. The other one is you have to know what it is. I think I learned this one in my psychedelic days in the 60s. It's okay to be crazy as long as, like, you know how to, like, keep up a good front.
Go with the flow a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. And that seemed to be part of it, just like – and acknowledging that you have a streak of craziness in you and you have to let it out every once in a while and crow at the sun.
That seemed to me – it was a terrific tale and seemed to me in some way a very Art Spiegelman tale. I mean, from the breadth and depth and sometimes crazy corners of your work, you've got a lot going on inside. You present it terrifically and let us all go through that window to see it. And we thank you for that. I wanted to ask you about, you know, the premise that, or the beginning attitude that you come to these challenging comics with. What's the Spiegelman premise versus the Disney premise, let's say, as the dominant comic book premise?
You know, I'm going to tell you an anecdote because we have time, I suppose,
yes,
based on the way this works. My baby daughter, Nadja, long time ago, George Bush the First is running for president. Mm-hmm. We're in the subway. She sees a poster. She asks me to explain why I was snarling at that poster. I tried very hard to explain to a little girl who's about three or four what there was about there were issues in this election campaign between Clinton and Bush. And I found myself sweating. I couldn't refer to the Constitution. She didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. I could refer to homeless people. I could refer to, like, who got what money. But I had to keep my frame of reference very focused in order to be able to communicate clearly with Nadja, even though I was trying to not dumb it down. I was just trying to find things that she could understand. So it was a long subway ride. At the end of it, she's kind of beaming. She got it. I get up, and there are all these adults who are sitting and standing near us in the subway. Mm. They applaud as we get off.
Because they heard you dealing
with it. I'd given a great political speech,
right,
evidently.
Right.
I guess there's a line I remember once reading from William Boyd, the guy who played Hopalong Cassidy. The secret to success was treat children like adults and adults like kids.
It is such a treat to have you with us tonight. I'm looking forward to the whole conversation. You know, you're quoted saying once, and of course anyone who's read Mao's knows this, I grew up being told by my Holocaust survivor parents that the world is an incredibly dangerous place and that I should always be prepared to flee. I know that's come into play in your life and many others through 9/11 recently, but what's your sense of children, of American children growing up now, do they have that sense of the world as a dangerous place, or are they still one foot in the American dream? What's the image you're writing for?
Well, I would like to protect my kids. I wouldn't like to see kids read Mouse until they're 30. Mm-hmm. I know that based on the kids I'm meeting, they're reading Mouse at a younger and younger age. So as well as having these adult readers, I have 11-year-old readers. Mm-hmm. And it's a testament to the democracy of comics that works. Well, look, my daughter was in Ground Zero when the whole madness hit the fan.
At your home in Soho or Stuyvesant?
She was at Stuyvesant. We ran down there, got her, and were running
school
uptown just a block away from the second tower when it fell right behind us. Mm. That whole school is filled with kids who witnessed this thing up close, witnessed bodies falling past their windows. Humans are amazingly resilient. And yes, kids have a wide-eyed innocence. It's their only childhood, you know, and they don't lose it. They just, like, manage to incorporate reality as it comes by. I'm not trying to depress any children. This book was not these little lit books are hardly horrific tales designed to scare children into adulthood. No. What they are is trying to encompass as much of what's real as possible with a sense of wonder, to give the gift of what it is to be able to read and think and look.
It's a great thing. Art Spiegelman, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with cartoonist Art Spiegelman about comics for kids in the world post 9/11. Can you picture Art Spiegelman as the new Mother Goose, the new Grimm Brothers? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with cartoonist Art Spiegelman about comics for kids in the world post 9/11. He's the 1992 winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his adult comic book, Mouse, A Survivor's Tale, about his parents' experiences during the Holocaust and his relationship with his parents, in particular his father. He's co-editor of the Little Lit series, hardcover children's storybooks, comic books, three out now. The third volume is out. It's called It Was a Dark and Silly Night. Is children's literature too saccharine for children? Is the cartoonist who illuminated the Holocaust too intimidating, or just what the kids need? Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Howard's calling from Plainville, Massachusetts. Hi, Howard. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you all tonight?
Very good, thanks.
Excellent. Mr. Spiegelman, it's a pleasure to talk to the man personally responsible for the wacky packages craze at West Annapolis Elementary School back in the mid-70s. I loved your work back then. I've been loving it ever since.
Well, yeah, the funny thing about that stuff, it's almost like an underground culture. If you're the right age, Wacky Packs looms as large as Arnold Schwarzenegger. But if you're 1 year too old or too young for it, it whizzes by you. So now I'm meeting these adults who are buying Garbage Pail Kids. And when I meet older people and say Garbage Pail Kids, they just look at me like people your age, I imagine, if you liked Wacky Packs, they look at me very blankly. You know, so it's this thing that cuts deeply into one zone of the culture. And I got to say, though, that the Dark and Silly Night and the other Little Lit books come from a different place than those stickers did. Because at that point, I was really feeding back the Mad Magazine lessons that corrupted me as a kid.
So that was Wacky Packs. Howard, have you read more recent work by Art Spiegelman?
Well, I remember when the first Mouse book came out, I grabbed it immediately when I heard it was coming out. I was very interested in not only the subject, but the way the subject was handled. And that was kind of my I'm going to broaden that and bring my next question to Mr. Spiegelman, then
please.
I'll hang up.
Yeah.
My question is that, in reading both volumes of Mouse, it appears that your relationship with your father is, shall we say, complex, to say the least. I was curious if that relationship, which appears to have started from your childhood, kind of moved you into comics in the first place, since comics are considered to be kind of a children's medium. And did your relationship really help you bring that sort of adult focus to what's considered a children's medium? Mm. And as a follow-up question, how have you been watching your relationship with your daughter and comparing that to your relationship with your father?
Oh, Howard, thanks. We've got it. Big and wide as the ocean there.
Well, let's see.
You know, if I may, Art Spiegelman, if you'd be good enough, Howard's Red Mouse.
Words or less.
Well, but some listeners haven't read Mouse. Could you give a bit, paint the picture of those, just in brief,
Mouse,
so they understand how your father comes in.
Fine. Mouse is a two-volume work originally that took me 13 years to do, a comic book about my relationship with my father and his story, which is his and my mother's story as Jews in Poland who lived through the Holocaust. And Vladek has grown up to be by the time I know him, is a really difficult man. And it just moves through that present relationship that he and I have into the stories telling me, all presented with characters who are bipeds, but mice for the Jews, cats for the Nazis, pigs for the Poles, dogs for the Americans, or at least dog masks, pig masks, which ultimately don't even define the personalities of the individuals, but are using Hitler's racist metaphor of Untermenschen and slave races, and working with that as the guiding visual metaphor to tell as accurately as I can the story of what he lived through. This was done from, I was working on this book from, I guess I started in 1978 and finished the second volume in 1991.
And the premise there is it's written, the narrator is now in the United States. His father is an old man, and he's both pulling the story of the Holocaust out of his father and conveying his own very complicated relationship with his Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, and, I'm trying to... I'm still thinking of Howard's questions.
Well, Howard's question really is, did that push you toward comics, cartoons somehow?
Well, what pushed me toward cartoons, of course, is I didn't grow up in, lucky for me, in Poland in 1939. I grew up in Rigo Park, Queens in 1959. Mm. So as a result, I was exposed to American culture, and comics were an important part of that culture. What made me move toward it is comics were not an important part of my father's culture. So comics were like dog whistles to him, and I needed to find a zone that he wouldn't find me in because we just didn't get along very easily. The only way my father influenced my life as a cartoonist is when he saw that I was spending 10 cents on a comic book and he could get two or three for a dime near the place where he worked as a salesman in the Diamond District. Mm-hmm. He insisted that I not buy comics and he buy me these old ones at three for a dime, where I got those great horror comics and weird comics of the 40s and 50s that were censored out of existence by the time I was reading comics off the newsstands, the ones that had caused juvenile delinquency and were probably responsible for warping me, the comics from the early 50s and late 40s. So other than that, let's see, to answer the other part of Howard's question that has to do with my children, with my son Dash and Nadja, I'm sure I'm making very different mistakes than my parents made, but I'm sure I'm making mistakes every day.
I wonder if the heart of that question may be whether the shadow, the energy of the Holocaust is still somehow in your parent-to-child relationship.
Well, I'm sure I'm more skitterish than some other more laid-back types that I've met who are more Americanly, more comfortable in their skin as Americans than I am. I would say that... Nadja took a very long time to read Mouse, and I think Dash still has a very vague idea that I ever did such a thing. He's much more aware of my children's books. Nadja seemed to get the whole story by osmosis and then eventually went back and just read it panel to panel. It's not like we talk a lot about it in the house, and it's not like it's a secret either. It's just what's more urgent to me is dealing with the contemporary political crises that we're in and the dangers that are around us now. I'm sure I bring my baggage to those dangers. And yet, what our dinner talk is about is not really about what Hitler did in 1941, but what Ashcroft, Bush, and the gang are doing in 2003.
And 2001 got you back into a comic strip in a big way. And I mean that literally. The whole back page of the broadsheet newspaper, The Forward, published in New York. I guess what, for a year, was it a monthly?
It was about once a month. I missed a couple of deadlines in there, so there's 10 of them.
Right.
And this was one of my epiphanies when we escaped from under the towers that morning of September 11th was, you know, Spiegelman, you should have done more comics. You've been doing all these covers for The New Yorker, writing essays, working on a piece of music theater. It's all well and good, but you blew it, man. You didn't do enough comics. That's what you can do best.
This could have been avoided if only...
My life was ending and I hadn't drawn enough comics. It's what I really believed I was going to die that morning. Mm-hmm. I guess I should say that. And I felt that I've kind of wasted this chance. There's something that I can do that has to do with putting words and pictures together in a specific way to make comics. And it's easier to just draw or to just write. And there are greater rewards for just being a writer or just being a drawer. You're penalized for having two sets of skills and learning how to interweave them.
Right, right.
And it's so labor intensive, you have to think you're going to live forever. So here at the moment where I thought I was buying the farm, I thought, man, you should have done more. So one of the promises I made to myself that morning was to move back into this more difficult territory and work on comics. But since I thought the world was ending, I didn't want to work on a book for for 13 years. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd never be able to get that done. So I worked in one-page units, but just really large pages.
These are big pages, big comics. Yeah. And in these, unlike the children's comics, you're taking on all the fear and darkness that a New Yorker would have felt after 2001, 9/11. I mean, this is really getting down to it.
Yeah, these are complex pages. Mm-hmm. These are complex pages, and they use a lot of different frames of reference, a lot of different drawing styles, a lot of different modes of telling even. Some of it's even funny. Some of it's rather personal and memoir-like about that morning for me. Some of it is very... I suppose, angry and political. Some of it's, I guess, a bit poetic. But I wanted to use that large expanse of a page when it became available to me.
What did you want to share on those pages, those dozen pages that you had in the foreword?
What I originally wanted to do is just work through my own trauma, frankly. Mm-hmm. But I knew that, like, I work slow. And I also knew that time would move things around. And I wanted to deal with what it meant to be looking at that glowing tower as it fell behind me, as I looked at it through a more and more distant scrim of time. And ultimately, let the world try to, like, move into that zone between that moment and now. So that eventually the strip became about, just because that's the way the world went and the way I understood it, what started out as a story about a hijacking of a plane turned into a story of a hijacking of a government and a country by my nominal leaders. So although I had vowed never to draw presidents, because those comics have very short shelf lives, mm-hmm. you know, you draw Woodrow Wilson, nobody wants to look at it in 4 to 8 years after.
Right,
so
right.
So I vowed not to, and yet the period we're living through, I think, is so fraught. I still think the world is ending. I just think it's ending more slowly than I did on September 11th and 12th and 13th, that the strip had to, like, engage with those issues as if this was life and death, that these were the moments that one had to look at as fully as one could.
Art Spiegelman's Politics and Passions are right there in those forward comics. Rick is calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I
Hi,
just
Rick.
Want to say, first of all, thank you to Mr. Spiegelman. As a college student, I learned a lot about the Holocaust through the symbols of his comic book. And I'm a teacher now in Wakefield, Massachusetts, and I will reference the book and show my students the characters, and the characters themselves as symbols really send a message to the kids and develops a lot of thinking skills.
The cats, and, the mice, the pigs, the dogs, and right on.
Fantastic. It's fantastic. Uh-huh. And I was wondering if you know of more comic strips like that I could bring into my history classes, because the kids are very impressed, and they end up learning a lot. So I was hoping maybe you had some more, or I could find out how I could access more.
It only took 13 years, Art Spiegelman. Couldn't you produce a few more?
Well, you know, there's a lot of great comics being made now. It's odd, but everybody's work is so different from everybody else's who's doing the great work. Everybody's reinventing what a comic might be. I don't know anybody else right now who's, let's see.
Taking on history?
Taking on history, per se. I mean, I'm very impressed with Joe Sacco's work. I don't know how old your students are, Rick.
They are 10th and 11th grade, so 15, 16 mm-hmm. years old.
They could deal with this. There's this guy Joe Sacco is the only comics artist I know with a journalism degree. He's done, like, one book called Safe Area Garajda about Bosnia and former Yugoslavia and the history there, close up, having spent a lot of time there. And he's also done a book called Palestine about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Again, very close up, spending time there, talking to people, drawing it very accurately. Those are well worth spending time with. The thing that I did that specifically had to do with these metaphoric characters, where I'm making a metaphor that's designed to self-destruct, is very specific to Mao's. You know, I don't know anybody else who's done anything specifically in that vein. There are books like Larry Gonick's History of the Universe and American history books that are kind of making certain kinds of information one can get very palatable. They're not as narratively driven as either uh-huh. Joe Sacco's book or my Mao's book.
So, Rick, there's a short list. Maybe that's a first place to look.
It's a nice place to start. And I'd like to say thank you. And it is a fantastic, fantastic teaching tool.
Rick, thanks very much for calling. Let's take another call right here. Jay's calling from Boston. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello, Mr. Spiegelman.
Hi, Jay.
I I have a great deal of respect for you, and I'd like to thank you for the contributions that you've made to the art form. I myself am a cartoonist. I'm presently in college. Presently, I have just founded a comic book library at the Massachusetts College of Art with a very small budget. And when the conversation on the air started today, you spoke about, you briefly touched upon the relationship between what would be considered or could be described as children's literature and the very tricky term of what constitutes comics. And I was just wondering, if someone asks you the fairly ridiculous question of why you make comics, I mean, I'm sure at this point in your life, there ideally will be less people asking you that. But what is it that you would describe as your as the basis for your affinity for the medium?
Jay, you mean why this instead of novels or painting canvases or something else?
Yes.
Something
making
special
movies.
Happens. Yeah, that's a good question, because something special happens when you put words and pictures together in what we get to call comics, which is they're not really like making pictures. The pictures are kind of iconic and stripped down compared to what you might do if you were an oil painter, representational painter. The narrative is done in very short bursts of language, and you have to think of each of the pictures as a kind of picture writing to put all these pictures together on a page to make a story. I think, you know, it's certainly not what compelled me to want to become a cartoonist when I first saw Mad Comics and Little Lulu when I was 10 years old. But at this point, I would say one of the things that's most compelling about comics to me is that comics echo the way the brain actually works. And that's why they go that deep in. I don't mean that you just see everybody's kind of goofy, cross-eyed and having buck teeth or something. But although I think cartoonist named Kaz, who works in the Little Lit series, does.
Right.
But I think that it has to do with the fact that we think in bursts of language, we think in visual icons. And as a result, comics move to a very deep part of the brain and make themselves felt in ways that are not the same as what happens when you get to passively watch a movie happen, you know? You're really dealing with the abstract mulch of thought turned into pictures and words. And that's it can have a powerful effect. I know that one thing that was very memorable and compelling for me when I was a kid is watching this girl in my fifth grade class reading a love comic book and crying. And I was going, wow, somebody can be moved to tears by a comic book
that deep.
And that was, to me, like opened up a whole other set of possibilities of what that meant, even though, you know, I'm sure if I'd read that particular Modern Bride comic, it wouldn't have moved me to tears. But the fact that it was possible.
Jay, if I may ask you, you're a young cartoonist. I mean, we can hear in many of the callers tonight, anybody who's read his work, the respect that's out there for Art Spiegelman. But as a young cartoonist, what is it exactly that makes you come bearing that big load of respect? How would you describe what it is about Art Spiegelman's work?
When I reread Mao's, I'm looking at the two volumes presently, and when I reread it, and there are the passages where the author is featured with the mouse mask somewhere on the panel, and there's this insular, very almost diorama feel to when you see the author speaking, and then you go to the narrative and to the two separate narratives of both the recollection and that which is being recollected, presented as though it is happening. And then when you see the author speaking, he's alone in a room. And the fact that I know that Dan Clowes wrote a manifesto a few years ago called Modern Cartoonist, and he gives a very short list of the professions and skills that a adept cartoonist.
Jay, we're out of time on that before the break, but we appreciate that perspective. Thanks for calling. Art Spiegelman, stand by. We're talking tonight with cartoonist Art Spiegelman, a cartoonist able to stand outside and look in very powerfully. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Art Spiegelman about comics for kids in the world post 9/11. Did you follow the cats and mice of Spiegelman's Mouse, and did it give you a deeper understanding of the Holocaust? Do we underestimate our children and the complexity of their perceptions of the world? Has Art Spiegelman changed the way you see the world? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Art Spiegelman, you're out with the third volume in this series of Little Lit. It was a dark and silly night. These comics are entitled, and you co-edit them with your wife, Francoise Mouly, if I pronounce that correctly.
Yep. Francoise is the art editor of The New Yorker, and we've been working together for years.
I wanted to ask about that. I've read that you said she had some influence on you deciding to go this way with children's books. Was that because she's French? She grew up with Asterix the Gaul and Tintin and all that stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, both Francoise and I learned to read from comics. Then we watched our kids learn to read by ruining my comic book collection. Our kids would have learned to read anyway, you know, because we read a lot. And yet, when our kids' friends would come over, they'd happily dive into the comics just as happily as go over and watch videotapes or play with the video games. And we realized there wasn't that much to turn those kids on to. Outside of sending them to these specialty comic shops to the back room where they might have some Donald Ducks left over or something, there wasn't much to steer them to. And it seemed urgent to us that something be out there that get kids to continue to learn to read. And basically, without wanting to make didactic stories, comics clearly do help kids. It's a gateway drug, comics. It gets you to read.
You can't stop once you start. I remember spending long, long days and nights just doing one comic after another at a certain age. I wanted to ask about the connection with The New Yorker and what it's like. You've done some of the most, I mean, in a magazine that has great covers, you've done some of the most iconic, the 1993 Kiss after the Crown Heights troubles of the Hasidic man and the African-American woman in that passionate embrace. And then, of course, after 9/11, those absolutely powerfully haunting two black towers on a black background. Can you describe the process of conceiving and executing a cover as opposed to a panel of a comic strip?
Yeah, it's a lot easier. That's why I avoided doing the comics. It's a flash of an idea that has to be gotten down to its essence, communicate well, become a poster that can sit around on a table for a while, which I suppose somewhere was part of that black-on-black cover, was knowing that a New Yorker cover stays around for a while, so light can hit it from different angles, and eventually you'll see these black towers coming out of the blackness.
Which were shiny, I guess, against a flat black background.
But just very, very slightly.
Very slightly.
The production people were great in terms of making it be a real Ad Reinhardt printed cover art of black-on-black stuff.
Oh, it was just fantastic.
But I suppose, like, each cover was a different thing. It was like trying to, you know, in a way, it's different but similar to these No Towers pages I've done over the past years, and that it's not so much that I'm trying to make a joke or I'm trying to even make a political cartoon that makes a point, although I've done that sometimes. But it's really like wanting to be a barometer, wanting to be a zeitgeist reader, trying to capture what's going through the atmosphere and kind of trap it in a picture, trap it in a strip.
You're brilliant at it. Andrew's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you. A few years ago, I was teaching at the University of Paris, and I wanted to introduce my children to the French bande dessinée, the comic book. So we went to the local library near the Bastille and asked where the comic books were. And were told, oh, not here in the children's section, they're in the adult section. And there was a large group of people reading comic books. More people than were reading newspapers or magazines or hardback books, and this seemed consistent throughout Paris. A few weeks later,
it was culture shock for me too.
Sorry?
That was a culture shock for me too when I first went to Paris.
I heard you mention that. You spoke at the Great Book Fair in Paris that year, and said that you were very keen on the French readership because adults considered comics to be their reading. And not
Andrew, did you dip into those comics, and did they satisfy you as an adult reader?
I have a vast collection of them, absolutely, yes. They're superb. They're things on their own. I'm a professor of literature, and they are their own genre. They're not just imitations of novels. They're a different ball game.
Andrew, our clock's going down, but thanks for that call. Let me put it to you, Art Spiegelman. Is there a certain kind of culture that encourages this? I mean, in Japan, of course, they've got the manga that everybody reads.
And in France, they get to call comics the ninth art with a straight face. They don't have any problems with this. We still have this vestigial kind of, assuming comics we assume comics are for kids, that they're kind of sub-literature. That's still somewhere in the back of our brain, no matter how many times we're exposed to different kinds of comics. And yet, it's beginning to change here. Yes, in Japan, it's astounding. Everybody reads comics from cradle to grave, and there are comics geared toward every interest.
And
certainly
are they
not
wild
superheroes.
Yep. Anika is calling. Hi. You're on the air, Anika.
Hi, Anika.
Hi.
How are you? Thanks for calling. Have you read Art Spiegelman's books, Anika?
Yes, one.
Which one?
It was A Dark and Silly Night.
Oh, the brand new one.
That's a new one.
What did you think of it?
I really liked it.
What about it?
Just all of them, because how they were all different, and they just were different.
Did they make you think about things you hadn't thought about before?
Yes.
Like what?
Like simple facts in life that people don't really think about often.
Ooh, you put your finger right on it.
Did you end up making your own Dark and Silly Night story? Did you end up thinking about, like, what? Because one of the things we wanted to do is offer, like, the magic of stories. Here we got all these different people together, and we said, okay, each of you do the same thing. Each of you take a story. The story starts with the phrase, it was a dark and silly night. What happened on that dark and silly night? And then everybody's idea of it was so different from everybody else's. That was the great thing for me about this particular book, is it's so clearly coming from one place and marching off in different directions.
Well, Anika clearly recognized that in your book. Anika, are you ready to read another one of these?
Yes.
That sounds like a positive vote. Anika, thank you so much for calling in. Our time
Anika,
is running
thanks.
Out.
Thank you very much, because that's much better than trying to explain that, children don't have to read stupid stuff.
It's just simple things in life that we need to know and you don't get told. Art Spiegelman, we're out of time, but it's been just great talking with you. Thanks so much for all of your work, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Art Spiegelman joined us from New York. He's a 1992 winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his adult comic book, Mouse, A Survivor's Tale. Is the third volume of his comics for kids is It Was a Dark and Silly Night in the Little Lit series. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The steel guitar is one of the staples of American country music, but the twanging instrument actually traces its roots back to 19th century Hawaii. This week, we're bringing you some of the best pieces of the year from On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors. Tonight, Ned takes us on a musical history of the steel guitar.
It's hard for us to imagine American country music without the steel guitar. But that iconic 20th century American sound came from the South Pacific in the late 19th century, the product of the cross-pollination of native Hawaiian and European cultures. The Hawaiians had no stringed instruments before the arrival of the Portuguese, Spanish, and South Americans, and they loved the new sounds of the guitar and the Portuguese braguin, the predecessor of the ukulele, adopting them as their own and redefining them along the way. There are a few competing stories as to the origins of the slide guitar, but most agree that around the mid-1890s, Juan Joseph Kekuku, a young Mormon growing up in Honolulu, tried laying a Spanish guitar in his lap, loosening a few of the strings so that the instrument played a major chord, and sliding a metal bar over the strings instead of pressing them down with his fingers. The instrument may have been European, but the sound was new and purely Hawaiian. The swooping glissando is a perfect mirror of native vocal technique. Hawaii was very much in the news in the 1890s. Within a year of the U.S. annexation of the islands in 1898, Thomas Edison had recorded Hawaiian music for a mainland American audience, but it didn't generate much interest. What really caused a stir was the successful run of Richard Walton Tully's 1912 Broadway production, Bird of Paradise, the story of a mainland pleasure boat run aground in Hawaii. A young man falls in love with a native girl and has to choose between paradise and urban civilization. Tully hired a native Hawaiian quintet for the production's incidental music, and this weirdly sensuous music, as it was described by a New York Times critic, hit a nerve. Soon after, the Victor Talking Machine Company brought the show's Hawaiian Quintet, slide guitar, ukulele, and all, into its New York studios to record music from Bird of Paradise. The records sold well. In fact, a full-blown craze for Hawaiian music swept the country. Native Hawaiian guitarists began arriving in California to ply their blend of traditional ragtime, blues, and Tin Pan Alley in hotels, restaurants, and vaudeville halls across America. Even Joseph Kikuku, the progenitor of the steel guitar, ended up playing an American vaudeville circuit. They also published steel guitar and ukulele methods books and took on American students. These musicians weren't purists. Hawaii had been an amalgam of musical influences since European contact in the 18th century. Here's Frank Ferreira, who sometimes used his Hawaiian name, Palakiko, playing Palakiko Blues on a Jeanette recording from 1921. Jimmy Rogers, known as the father of American country music, was recording for Victor Talking Machine Company in their Camden, New Jersey studios in 1928. He was teamed up with a small ensemble that included an American-born string wizard by the name of Ellsworth T. Cousins. On this session, he played banjo, mandolin, and slide guitar. Here's Cousins' slide introduction to the Sailor's Plea and what might well be the first pairing of an American country artist with a Hawaiian guitar. By 1929, Jimmy Rogers was a successful and nationally known hillbilly artist, and not troubled at all about the purity of country music. He penned a Hawaiian-style novelty tune with his sister-in-law called Everybody Does It in Hawaii, and recorded it with the help of transplanted Hawaiian guitarist Joe Kaipo. It was left to the public imagination what everybody in Hawaii was actually doing.
I'm going to take my hula, hula girl, and bring her.
The Hawaiian guitar was the first guitar to be electrified. Taking advantage of early 1930s technology, an electric pickup that transmits the vibration of metal strings to another new invention, the audio amplifier. The Electro String Company began marketing the first electric Hawaiian guitars in 1931. We don't know who the guitarist is in this recording, but here's the Noilani Orchestra in February of 1933 in Aloha Dreams, the first recording of an electrified guitar. Country music met the electrified Hawaiian guitar in the work of Bob Dunn. As a boy in the 20s, Dunn had studied a methods book by Walter Kalamuko, who'd played in Tully's Bird of Paradise troupe. As steel guitarist with Milton Brown and his musical Brownies, a pioneer Western swing band, Dunn brought this powerful solo instrument right up front in this 1936 recording of Crafton Blues. By the 1950s, nothing could sound more natural, more American, than the drifting, plaintive sounds of the instrument that Hawaiians had adapted a half century earlier. No longer an exotic voice from paradise, the steel guitar was the sound of the prairie, the highway, and the honky-tonk. Here's Hank Williams in 1952, backed by his steel guitarist Don Helms in Honky-Tonkin'.
Well, I left my home down on the rural route. I told my pa I'm going stepping out and get the honky-tonk blues. Hey, the honky-tonk blues. Hey, Lord, I got 'em. I got the honky-tonk blues.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Woke up this morning wishing I could lose them jumping honky-tonk blues. Hey, the honky-tonk blues.